time for this week's education feature in partnership with Wits Business School, and we've been taking a tour through the world of business education with our partner over the last few weeks. And I was reading a very interesting interview with Nitin Noria, who's the Dean of Harvard Business School recently, and he said a sense of business history is important for business leaders to develop a contextual intelligence about what's happening in the world of business and a strong sense of where we're going. Now, that's certainly what my next guests have in spades when it comes to the world of business, innovation and academia. Dr. Sibusiso Sibisi, Director and Head of the Wits Business School, and Dr. Duran Simoni, a Senior Lecturer in Innovation Management and Policy at Wits Business School. Evening, gentlemen. Great to have you on the show. Dr. Sibisi, let's start with you. You've got a formidable CV, and looking through it, one doesn't know where to start, but you've almost come full circle, having lectured at Wits in the mid-1980s. So take me through that path that led you now to head up the business school.
Good evening, Michael. Yes, indeed. I started lecturing at Wits in mathematics many years ago, before returning to Cambridge, where I'd studied earlier, then coming back to South Africa and joining private sector, subsequently being a deputy vice chancellor for research at the University of Cape Town, and then a long spell at CSIR as CEO for close to 15 years. Then I thought I'd gone into retirement, and I've come back out, and I've now joined Wits again at Wits Business School, and I'm thrilled, I'm delighted to be here.
And I see you were a keen rower at Cambridge too, Dr. Sibisi. Do you still row when you get the opportunity?
I haven't actually rowed for quite a while. I use the concept to the rowing machine at gym quite a bit, but I have not been on the river in an eight for a long time.
Dr. Simoni, looking through your CV as well, do they row at Georgia Institute of Technology, your alma mater?
No, there may have been. I wasn't involved in the rowing activities. I'm not very sports inclined other than watching it.
Now, how did you come to arrive at Wits Business School?
Yes, so I studied in the U.S. I studied to be a materials science and engineer, and I was a materials engineer for a number of years. And I got to understand how science and the world of business, science and society interact, and the enabling environment that's put in place in the U.S. context to make the society a competitive, knowledge-driven economy. And so I thought I would go and do a PhD in innovation studies and energy policy to study that deliberately instead of getting it via experience. And so Georgia Tech was central in terms of exposing me to that. But also my undergrad university, Tuskegee University, got me into scientific research as an undergraduate. So I came in from the engineering side, and then I transitioned into science, policy, and innovation studies.
And if we look at any country in the world, there are few better, perhaps maybe Singapore or Israel, at commercializing their innovation and their R&D. So a great place to study how successful societies do that. Dr. Sibisi, we've got our own challenges in South Africa. We've got the National Development Plan, which is really our lodestar to 2030, and it places science, technology and innovation really at the center of our developmental agenda. But if you look at it, it's not government's role alone. The Department of Science and Technology can't drive this and achieve this aim by itself. It's really vital that business and labor and academia and government all start working together to achieve a knowledge-based economy. What do you see as the business school's role in this?
That's absolutely correct. And I believe necessarily the activities that need to be undertaken in order to get science and technology to contribute to our economic fortunes in this country is to adopt that kind of partnership, collaborative approach, multidisciplinary approach to getting things done. I believe strongly that the business school has a role not just in the thought leadership, but in bringing together groups to think about what are the classic example is our energy challenges today. What would we need to do from the perspective of technology, from the perspective of development of new materials, from the perspective of a business model that would actually make sense to be able to pilot on a significant scale solutions that may be founded upon the renewables energy arena, to gas and so on and whatever else, but have an ambitious plan of getting our energy problems sorted in a manner that would involve thinking from economists, from scientists, from people with an understanding of business. So beyond the business school, simply running courses, programs, teaching programs, but thinking, trying things, working together, and adopting, in this, in the particular case of Wits University, a whole of Wits approach, where we bring you bring the whole university together with other people.
And the space itself, if you look at a business school, it provides an apolitical platform to bring the various parties together and really use that approach of academia, of testing hypotheses, of an evidence-based scientific approach to solving some of our problems. And one looks at South Africa today, and we do tend to get bogged down in the isms and ideologies. In the space of a business school, one can hopefully move beyond that.
I cannot agree more. Absolutely. Take it well beyond the odd seminar, thinking about what is possible, to having a conversation of how we can actually collectively make it happen. And I think a partnership where the people from industry, it may even be areas that we have not conducted research in before. And the way I tend to think about it is, for example, we are very good at thinking about grand science, and Department of Science and Technology has done very well in that regard. And we talk a lot of the time about the Square Kilometer Array, which is indeed a very exciting, a big science project. And I myself am passionate about science. But can we have the equivalent, an SKA equivalent in energy, for example, in health, in nutrition, and really drive it on a grand scale? That necessarily would involve partnerships across the board.
That really is all about partnerships. It's too big for any one party to collaborate solely with those inside a particular sector or industry. You have to branch out. When we look at it, Dr. Zamani, we also need to ask whether the national system of innovation responds adequately to the future, whether all of the institutions are still relevant and optimally configured, and whether we need to perhaps even think about creating new institutions when it comes to innovation. What are your thoughts on this?
Indeed, South Africa has one of the more advanced national systems of innovation, which simply means that how do public and private entities interact to address national goals as they relate to the diffusion of technology, new technologies, and so on. And so South Africa, four or five countries, has one of the more impressive programs and reviews itself periodically. So the first science and technology strategy came out in 1996. In 2008, another strategy came out, a 10-year plan. In 2011, there was a ministerial review on science and technology. And it spoke precisely to what you're suggesting, that there's a sense in which the innovation strategy of South Africa is located within the Department of Science and Technology, but should have a much more cross-cutting impact on other government departments and other sectors of the economy. And so this is essentially what the challenge is, and it's been recognized. It's about implementing it into practice. And so from a business school perspective, we're trying to understand theoretically what the underpinnings of these various understandings of a national system of innovation is, and based on experiential and evidentiary base, begin to see in different sectors how this diffusion might actually happen.
I often like to joke in some jest, but with some truth, that the word silo was invented in the bank. It could equally have been invented in large governments. So very often you do see silo thinking in departments where, if you can cut across the challenges in South African society, and Dr. Sibisi, to come back to your example of energy, we have a great challenge now in the water sector as well. And there's a nexus, an intersection between water and energy, and indeed agriculture. So should we start to be thinking of how we solve for those challenges across the various departments, rather than applying that silo mentality?
We should indeed, and it's interesting that in our conversation so far we've made mention of the Department of Science and Technology, but it's imperative, for example, that there be joined up thinking that naturally brings in trade and industry, naturally brings in the Department of Energy, naturally brings in all the players on a basis that is determined by need, by relevance, to work together seamlessly in order to address these problems, because these problems are by no means restricted to particular boundaries. In fact, the water is a very good metaphor, because rivers even run across boundaries of nations. So we need to be also thinking regionally about how we work together across countries. Address this challenge.
It is a very good metaphor indeed in the South African context, because as we know, we are one of the driest countries in the world, but also every single river starts with that single drop. So it's about asking, as business, as the various stakeholders, what is the drop that you're going to be adding to the bucket that will hopefully start spilling over into these rivers of innovation? We're talking about the country's innovation system and structure with Dr. Sibusiso Sibisi, Director and Head of the Wits Business School, and Dr. Duran Simoni, a senior lecturer in innovation management and policy, also at Wits Business School. And gents, we're talking about some broad issues, the macro issues around the structure of innovation in South Africa and what the NDP says and the need for collaboration. I'd like to just hone in on commercialization of R&D now. And a very interesting report was produced by William Galston, who looks at the Ezra K. Zika Chair in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institute in the US. And he really looks at what, and he was writing in the Wall Street Journal, what makes innovation successful and how do successful countries commercialize innovation. And one of their findings that stands out is that the number of top innovations originating in federal laboratories in the US, universities or firms formed by former researchers in those entities rose dramatically from 18 in the 70s to 37 in the 80s up to 55 in the 90s before falling slightly in the 2000s. Now really the upshot of this is that what we see in the US is academia playing a driving role in developing research and development and innovation, but then their system allows that research and development to then be commercialized. They can transfer their technology, they've got the entrepreneurial nous to go and make a success of it. Dr. Sibisi, what are we seeing in South Africa? Are we as successful in commercializing our R&D?
One, I think, has to admit that not quite. But we have got good policy, we've got good thinking, there's no doubt about it. We have been very good at, for example, looking at the drivers from a policy perspective in the US, such as the Bayh-Dole Act, which effectively called for universities to commercialize the IP that they develop or run the risk of losing it. But when you do that, you then also put in place a policy that funds the technology transfer offices and that at the respective universities. Now, when you do so, you have to also understand that the potential implications are very far-reaching. You need to be able to, for example, defend your IP rights or your patents in the event of infringement internationally and so on. And the recognition and the ability to do all of that and fund all of that all the way through is something where in South Africa one might, can argue with some evidence there have been gaps in doing so. And then so we need to improve that journey from the point of, for example, taking out a patent and the ability either to commercialize it or to defend your rights with regard to that IP in the event of international infringement.
And there seems to be an important role there, Dr. Sibisi, for the business school to play, to help equip those entrepreneurs with those skills.
Without a doubt. And I look at my colleague sitting next to me here. These are exactly the sort of areas that we jointly think about and often talk about. And the role of the business school, I think, would be exactly one, ought to be, one of bringing together, not necessarily doing the work itself, but doing the thought leadership and coordinating of parties as a neutral player of the various parties who ought to be involved in thinking through what we ought to do as a country.
Dr. Simoni, what would you like to add to that?
Yes, I would like to say that, first of all, I think of commercialization as a subset of diffusion, technology diffusion. What do I mean by that? South Africa is classified as an upper middle income country, which means that based on a certain innovation, school of innovation theorists called catch-up economics, it should be knocking on the door of becoming an upper income or advanced industrialized country. But if you look at the socioeconomic characteristics of South Africa, it's more akin to a lower middle income country. So in effect, you have a bifurcated society. And so if you say, if you think of R&D commercialization in a narrow sense, then that's oriented towards export-oriented global competitiveness. But that same innovation capability should be oriented towards solving the socioeconomic characteristics of the country. And that's not necessarily a primarily profit-driven exercise. However, if you're able to solve problems such as water, sanitation, access to electricity, healthcare issues, then you've built the type of competence that allows you to build products and services that can grow, that can be competitive internationally. So, and the NDP speaks to that, the Science and Technology Innovation Strategy of South Africa speaks to that, and is very conscious about that. So those two orientations are important to address on their own merits and then find ways for them to come back together. So that's one point I would like to make. Yes.
Well, and just to add on to that, it's very interesting having facilitated a few events recently where the focus from a capital provider's perspective, a private equity conference talking about environmental, social, governance issues and particularly impact investing, is really a key driver for global capital at the moment seeking returns that are market-based and competitive, but that solve for social issues in the healthcare space, in providing education, or be it energy or water. So there's certainly capital to be unlocked there if we can orient our innovation systems and aim them, as you say, towards some of those social issues. How do we do that? Can you give me a few ideas on how we achieve that and perhaps move away from just thinking that everything is a unicorn in Silicon Valley and has to be export-oriented?
Right. Okay. So we're talking about R&D commercialization, and the assumption or the bias is that most novel knowledge or technologically important knowledge will come from a scientific R&D lab. And yes, we agree that at the frontiers of knowledge, that is indeed true. But that should not negate the fact that there's knowledge to be found in enterprises, in design and engineering firms, in the informal economy, in indigenous communities, in grassroots innovation. And so it cannot be that the science lab has to think about all of these sectors and push solutions towards them. We should also interact with them to find out, well, what do you know? How do you solve your problems of malnutrition? How do you solve your problems of pests? How do you solve your problems? And so on and so forth. And so the science and technology system is now augmenting what people already do rather than sort of introducing highly novel technologies. And so we've seen so the manufacturing base that's linked to the science and technology base and the diffusion base, it's a bi-directional, at least bi-directional approach to innovation. So just a very quick example, I'm very interested in nanotechnology, which is in nanomaterials specifically, which is about looking at manipulating matter at the nanoscale, so 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter. And so this is very advanced technology that has applications in clean water solutions. And so some scientists at the University of Virginia are looking at clean water applications, and they went to the University of Venda, where they are involved in infectious disease research program. And they say, well, how do we use nanotechnology to kill all the pathogens in the water? Well, we need people who can make water filters, and those water filters are ceramic water filters made of clay pots. And who knows how to make clay pots? Elderly women who are experts in pottery, but do it for ornamental purposes, flower pots and so on. So, well, you know how to make clay pots. You understand where to find clay in the area. We know how to make nanotechnology solutions. Can we come together? And so you have this wonderful system where the women make the clay pots in their spare time, in addition to making other kinds of pots, and the nanoscientists paste a coating of nano solution, so the clay pot filters the water, but only for particulate matter, whereas the nanotechnology solution kills all the pathogens. And so you have a combination of low tech and high tech, you have an inclusive innovation agenda where you have people with diverse sets of skills, none of whom would be able to do it on their own. And this is the kind of joint effort at innovation that we would like to promote, certainly in the programs we teach at the business school.
What an exciting example.
Absolutely. It is an absolutely wonderful example that my colleague gives. And as it happens, it touches upon something that we talk about a great deal of the manner in which we set about adding value, our own natural resources, such as clays. And in fact, in that context, it's well worth pointing out that there's significant expertise in that very area of nanoclays, of working with clays in the manner that my colleague has described at the Center for Nanotechnology at the CSIR, which is in fact an example of a success story of a center that was set up from scratch and has become an excellent center over a period of time. Now, but what I want to add is that we have to make some choices. We were talking about the U.S. earlier, but we need also understand that we are a society where we cannot necessarily say we look at everything. Mm. And we need consciously to make some choices. If, for the sake of argument, the choices are, let us look at beneficiation of our natural endowments in the form of, clays, in the form of, for example, titanium. Then we develop the expertise to beneficiate titanium. I choose that example advisedly because that's an area that we've looked into as a country as well. And so we then make those choices and scale up and build and look to building industries or indeed work that may benefit communities that then might be the competitive basis for the country. This is how ultimately a big hitter like Sasol was put together, through that kind of identification.
Exactly, and to a conversation that I was having with another colleague of yours, Dr. Rod Crompton, about developing a way of substituting the import of ammonia in South Africa, and we could once again use Sasol-type technology and build industry champions that could become major employers, but one needs to take that sort of holistic future-looking, forward-looking approach. Dr. Sibisi, I was hoping to chat to you about one of the other interests because I was hoping we would have time, but unfortunately we run out of time, so I'm going to have to welcome you back at a later stage to talk about the world of analytics. I know Bayesian technology is one of your favorite subject matters.
Indeed so. I would love to do that anytime.
Well, with that, unfortunately, as I said, we have run out of time, but it's been absolutely fascinating sharing your insights, Dr. Sibosiso Sibisi, Director of the WITS Business School, and Dr. Duran Samani, Senior Lecturer in Innovation and Management Policy at WITS Business School. And quite clearly, the school is in more than capable hands as we forge our future into the world of innovation and science and technology in South Africa. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, Michael, and thank you for having us.